Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Andy Finn Show. I'm Andy Finn, the Finn Man, and for the next hour, you're in Finland. Today is Monday, the 9th of June, and we have had an eventful week in the world of politics because Hillary gave up the ghost last week, so we now are down to the final two. Kind of like one of those game shows, you know? But before we get to all of that and what's new in the news, on June 9th, in the year 2000, the U.S. House of Representatives voted to repeal the gift and estate tax. Now, you may not remember much about this because it's as though they didn't do it. They've kind of backed off of most of their much of what they did with this stuff, but also it's the anniversary of the Los Angeles Lakers winning the NBA title in 1985. They beat the Boston Celtics. Well, and that was one of the first years they managed to overcome the Celtics. The Celtics have quite a string, quite a bit of dominance. But as you might know, the Lakers and Celtics are at it again. We've had two games, and the Celtics are up 2-0, but that's to be expected since both games were in Boston. But the question is, can Kobe do it without Shaq? Can he and Kevin Garnett and the gang do it without Shaq? We'll find out. I'm guessing it's Boston's year, but we'll see. And also in the world of sports, whatever people think is going to happen that's predictable often doesn't happen. For example, we had the Belmont Stakes run on Long Island this past weekend, and everyone assumed that Big Brown would win the Triple Crown. Why they assumed it, I don't know, since we haven't had a Triple Crown winner since 1977, 31 years. That's a long time, you know. But a couple of unusual things happened, and I'm not a big horse racing fan, although I did live in Lexington, Kentucky for 6 years. And I do have a nice picture of racehorses on my dining room wall in my house. But it's weird what happened. A couple of things happened. One is that this horse finished last in the field. I don't know that that's ever happened to the prohibitive favorite or to a horse that's won two legs of the Triple Crown. But also, what was weird was that the horse went off, Big Brown went off at 1-4 odds. That is, if you were to put down $4, you get $1 back. Well, that doesn't make any sense. You get $4 plus $1 back, I guess, is how it works. It just isn't good odds. But the point was, nobody bet on anybody but Big Brown is what it comes down to. So don't need to spend a lot of time on that. But it just shows to go, you, how experts believe they know how it's going to come out, and the average fan believes, and that's why they play the game, that's why they run the races. Speaking of a race that is run, Jim McKay died this last week. Jim McKay was a sportscaster, mostly with ABC, and he announced all kinds of things from horse racing back in the, horse racing, but also NASCAR back in the 70s to the Olympics, to a variety of things. At the 1972 Munich Olympics, when the Israeli athletes were taken hostage, he turned into a newsman because ABC had a crew on the set, and so he ended up reporting about that tragedy. But he had a long career in sports, and that's all we need to say about Jim McKay. I don't know if you heard about this lake in China that was formed after the earthquake. It's been called Quake Lake. But basically, if you saw the aerial photos of it in the newspapers, there was a slide of a lot of rock and dirt down a mountainside, a steep mountainside, into a valley, and it dammed up a river. And so behind it began to form this big lake. Well, the problem is it's only an earthen dam and a temporary one at that that the quake caused. So if you get enough water built up behind it, you can expect it will burst at some point. And, of course, the risk then is that that water will all come down the valley very, very quickly, and there were towns below the valley that were in great danger. So Chinese engineers figured out how to cut a path, a sluice, through the earthen dam that had been temporarily built up and start letting some of that water out. The problem is you have to evacuate people down below, because once you start letting water out by digging a trench through an earthen dam, a temporary earthen dam at that, just formed by falling rock, there's a good chance that it could still give way and you'd have a big mess on your hands. So apparently it has been a success. The earthen dam did not give way faster than they wanted it to, and mostly they've relieved most of the pressure behind that temporary dam, and it's there in good shape. A little bit more in the world of international news. The Burmese authorities, that is Myanmar, to those of you that watch Seinfeld, the Burmese authority arrested a celebrity, a comedian whose name is, how do you pronounce it? Zarganar, I guess is his name. He has been criticizing, he's a comedian who criticizes the government, but he's been organizing cyclone relief, and they've arrested him, in part because he criticized the relief effort. You know, if there was ever a time that called for bold action on the part of the world, this is it. It's pretty hard to understand, you know, when we don't get cooperation from somebody, whether it's Kosovo, you know, Serbia and Kosovo, or it's Saddam Hussein, we don't hesitate to drop bombs on the country. But when we can't get food aid and other kinds of relief supplies into victims because the government's dragging their feet and likely to kill hundreds of thousands of people through inattention, we are too timid. I've said this on this show before, but if the UN isn't willing to do it, the United States and its allies should do it. We can't get permission for Marine helicopters to airlift aid in. We should do it anyway, and we should have helicopter gunships and fighter planes, and if the Burmese try to shoot us down or stop us from doing it, just tell them we're going to take you out. And we should be bombing them with aid. We're going to see somewhere between 100,000 and a million people die, not of starvation, but of dysentery and all kinds of disease, because they don't have clean drinking water, they don't have adequate supplies, medical treatment supplies, food, all of it. And we can see it coming, and we're not doing much about it. It's pretty sad. But I do understand that's the way the world works. That is, man is not really capable of functioning and protecting the population on the earth. We just can't get it done yet. We're not that powerful. In the same vein, the UN is calling for quick action on the global food crisis. If you're not up to date on this, the global food crisis is another disaster waiting to happen. And here's the thing, we can see it coming. Basically, the price of food has gone up so much that poor people around the world can't afford it. They're now spending, they were already spending too much of their total income, which, you know, might be a dollar a day or something, on food. And now the price of food has doubled, tripled, quadrupled in some places in the world. There just isn't enough money in the budgets of poor people to feed themselves and their families. We know that this problem is coming. In fact, there are 6-point-some billion people on the planet. As many as 1 billion people may be endangered by the global food crisis. It isn't that there isn't enough food. There's food in different places. We store a lot of it. Other countries have it. it's that the price of it is so high that people will starve to death before they can, rather than get food. That's not good, but that's what we're headed for. And let's see, a couple more international stories, and then we'll move on to domestic stuff. The situation in Zimbabwe continues to deteriorate. If you remember from our last episode, Robert Mugabe lost the first election. He didn't like the idea that he lost the election, so he waited for a month to release the results, even though they released the results of the congressional, as you, equivalent of congressional and local elections within 3 days. He held off on releasing the results of the other election, the presidential election. He then, when they released it, he claimed that his opponent only got 49.3%, or maybe it was even less than that, they claimed, and that he got 43%, so we needed a runoff election. If no one gets 50%, there's a runoff between the top two candidates. Well, Mugabe, who's a hero there and has been in power for a long time, and helped overthrow the previous government back in like the 60s, he's 84 years old now, he is well past his prime, and he's a despot, and he rules with an iron fist at times, and he's not good for the country. So they waited a month, then they released the figures. It's suspicious, but they're going to have a runoff election. Well, his challenger could easily beat him in a runoff election, but Mugabe's supporters are out. First of all, they are killing some of his opponent's supporters. Okay, his opponent's name is Morgan Savangarai, and he's the leader of the Movement for Democratic Change. He has been arrested twice in the last week by Mugabe supporters, taken off the street, put in prison for a few hours. For trumped-up reasons, he's out campaigning for the presidency. Can you imagine what that would be like? It would be as if the Bush administration, in an attempt to help John McCain, arrested Barack Obama while he's in Virginia campaigning last weekend. That's nuts. But that's what happens in some of these countries, and that's what's happened in Zimbabwe. The fear is that Mugabe's going to steal this election, steal this runoff by intimidation, by stuffing the ballot box. There was also a UN and U.S. Convoy that was going around looking to see the extent of the human rights violations that are going on right now. They got pulled over and intimidated, and when they refused to follow the police back to the police station because they were a diplomatic car with diplomatic passports, and there were no good reason for them to be stopped and hassled. When they refused, I think the police slashed their tires or else shot out their tires. In the end, the situation was defused, but that's our diplomats. And I think it was British diplomats or Canadian diplomats this was happening to. Mugabe is trouble. So I fully expect they'll try and steal that election. We'll see what happens. Moving on to another topic, there was an interesting article in the Washington Post today, June 9th, 2008, and basically it's buried on page A12, but it's simply Iran urges closer defense ties with Iraq. And then the subtitle is Tehran increasingly uneasy about Baghdad's proposed security pact with the U.S. Now, there's two ways to read this kind of article. If you are buying into all the fear-mongering that goes on in this country, we are led to believe that Iran is this huge, huge threat to us here in the United States. And so people would look at this article and say, oh, yeah, Iran wants closer ties with Iraq. Who are we kidding? Iraq needs to stay on our side. But what we fail to realize is that in the geopolitics of the region, Iran has legitimate interests in its neighbors. In the same way we have legitimate interests in what happens in Canada and what happens in Mexico, and Brazil has legitimate interests in things that happen on its border, and Russia has legitimate interests, China has legitimate interests, the European countries have legitimate interests in the things that happen on their borders, Iran has legitimate interests in terms of the things that happen on its border. And it's concerned that the United States, in trying to put forth a pact to have a security pact, a long-term security agreement with Iraq, that that is going to harm Iran's interests. So I'm not going to go any further into it than just to say that this is just a straightforward report about the fact that if you were in Iran, you'd see this a lot differently. Okay. Now, never mind that the fact we're trying to demonize Ahmadinejad and he's making it easy for us. People forget that Ahmadinejad has very little power in Iran. Every time someone calls him a madman. Have you ever noticed that a lot of the enemies of our country are run by madmen? Like North Korea, Iraq. I'm sorry, Iran, Iraq, before we overthrew Saddam Hussein, the Soviet Union in the old days, although I don't think we called them madmen exactly, but there's others as well. But that's part of the fear process. So I'm not saying Iran isn't a threat, but, you know, this got blown out of proportion with Barack Obama and John McCain a few weeks ago, right? When someone asked Barack Obama about it, or maybe McCain or Bush made a comparison to Hitler, and Obama said, look, Iran just isn't that big a threat. And right away, McCain and people in the Bush administration jumped on and said, oh, he's saying that Iran's not a threat. How naive can you be? No, what he said was, Iran is not the kind of threat the Soviet Union was. The Soviet Union was an existential threat. That is, they threatened our very existence. If one side or the other miscalculated and pushed the button, and we fired even a portion of our 10,000 nuclear weapons at each other, eventually we got up to about 20,000 nuclear weapons each, if we'd fired even a small subset of those at each other's countries, we essentially would have annihilated each other. That's how serious the threat from the Soviet Union was back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. Okay, that's huge. What Obama was saying by comparison is, you know, Iran is relatively small potatoes relative to that kind of a concern. And right away, people jumped on him from the right, the Republicans and the McCain campaign, and said, oh, Obama's saying that they're not a threat. No, he's saying that they're not as big a threat as the Soviet Union was. Yes, they're a threat, but let's not raise them to a level of importance they don't deserve. They're not our equal, militarily or in the world, in terms of influence. We shouldn't make them a one-on-one enemy and give them that rise in stature. That's the kind of thing Ahmadinejad is looking for. But I think the people that peddle fear won't ever quite understand that. Hey, on Wednesday night, REM is coming to Meriwether Post here in the D.C. area in Columbia, Maryland. And in honor of REM coming, we're going to not play our usual parody songs tonight, but we're going to hear a little bit of live REM on The Andy Finn Show on WEBR Radio. We are back on the Andy Finn Show, and we're listening to a little bit of REM on our break here because they're going to be in town Wednesday night at Meriwether Post. On this date in, let's see, 1963, Johnny Depp was born. 1961, Michael J. Fox, a couple of pretty decent actors. Also, this is the date in 1959 that the first ballistic missile was launched on a submarine. The submarine, the George Washington, was launched, and it carried ballistic missiles for the first time. It was quite an engineering feat figuring out how to fire ballistic missiles from underwater. In fact, in the beginning, they had to surface to fire their weapons, and then we figured out how to do it without surfacing. So now you've seen The Hunt for Red October. We can hide out and have these wild card nukes out there. Let's get back to, before we get to the 2008 campaign, there's several, three related issues here that involve the president. The first is the weird thing that's going on with the economy. The stock market has been down. The unemployment rate has been going up. We're up to 5.5%. It hasn't been that high since near the end of 2004. And oil is back up. So, you know, it's funny. The price of oil went up $11. I think it was last Friday. And it closed at a record, $138.50 or something. What's interesting, when I heard about this, was I couldn't help remembering that I'd seen a segment on listened to a segment on the Rush Limbaugh show. Don't ask me why. But Rush was explaining to his audience how, see, I told you the price of oil had to fall. This was back, like, last Wednesday, when it had fallen from a high of 135 back to 123 or something, and Rush was feeling vindicated that he was right, that it had to fall. Well, it can't rise forever, so when you get to a peak, chances are it will fall some, but the question is where it's going to end up. And we're back to $138 for a barrel of oil. And, of course, we hit $4 gasoline this past weekend. The average price of unleaded regular, that is the cheapest gas you can find in the United States, across the entire United States, hit $4 a gallon. Of course, it's been at $4 for quite some time in many places, but it now hit $4 a gallon. And it was just 3 months ago, folks, a little more than 3 months, really. 3 months and a week or 9 days, it was February 28th. That President Bush was asked a question about the economy, and he said, with many economists predicting $4 gasoline, Mr. President, and Bush interrupted the reporter and said, $4 a gallon gas? I hadn't heard that. So 3 months before it happens, he was unaware it was even possible that gasoline would go to $4 a gallon. Of course, there was no guarantee it would, but it was being predicted by a lot of people. 3 months later, it comes true. And it just kind of shows you the bubble he's living in or how uninformed he is. Because I'm sure his advisors knew that $4 a gallon gas was possible. So it's in that vein that there was a summary in today's Washington Post, an article by Dan Egan. And basically he recounted over the last few months the approach that President Bush is taking in a lot of his speeches. And basically, he's citing history a lot to argue that one day his policies will be vindicated. Right? Now, you've heard this argument in different ways at different times, but basically, Bush is saying that there will be vindication. He will, whether it's going into Iraq or it's tax cuts or whatever, over time, he'll be proven right. And an interesting phenomenon with President Bush is that he got interested in reading presidential biographies once he was a president. He might have read them beforehand, I don't know. But he once said to a some visiting dignitaries from Eastern Europe when he was showing them around, and there was a portrait of George Washington on the wall, and he said, "This is George Washington, our first president." And this is an exact quote. He told them, "One of the interesting things about George Washington is that I read 3 books about him last year." Enough said. Anyway, he started to read biographies of Truman and Lincoln and other embattled presidents who were later vindicated by having been shown to have their standing increased in the world, and so or by history. And so that's kind of what he's counting on, because, of course, that's all you have, all he has. And you can't argue when someone says, you know, in 30 years we'll look differently at this. You know, what do you say to that? It's possible we will. You know, it doesn't seem likely that he's going to be vindicated on Iraq, but he went over to Europe, I'm sorry, over to the Middle East, and said something about this, how did he put it? He tried to get the leaders of in the Middle East to see that in 60 years, things could be turned around. There could be peace in the Middle East. It is possible. Anyway, the Senate Intelligence Committee, the Select Committee on Intelligence, put out a report last week, and it was the final segment of a report that had been promised for several years on the issue for the intelligence about Iraq and the reasons we went to war. Now, if you remember, when the Congress was first looking into this, the Republicans were in power in the Senate and the House, and they limited the investigation to just how good a job did the CIA do? Did they give us the right intelligence? And what the Democrats did when they got, actually, they had an agreement at the time with the Republicans that there would be a second phase and that they would look at how the intelligence was used by the administration and whether or not it was politicized or cherry-picked. And the Republican leadership kept putting that part of the investigation off. Well, then Democrats took over. After the 2006 election, they took over the House, so now the Democrats run the committees, and so the Democrats went ahead with this report. Now, they got 2 Republicans to sign on to the findings, meaning they made the findings palatable enough that at least 2 Republicans on the committee, typically these committees are about 20 people, maybe 18, and so you're going to end up with something like, in a close Senate like we have now, there might have been 11 Democrats and 9 Republicans, something in that mix. I'm not really sure with this committee. But the 2 Republicans voted with them and the rest voted against. So it carried it with, quote, bipartisan support. But Fred Hyatt had an editorial in today's Washington Post, June 9th, 2008. Basically, and it's titled, "Bush Lied? If Only It Were That Simple." Well, Fred Hyatt is I think he's the managing editor of the editorial page, the editor of the editorial page, and he is heavily invested in the Iraq war because the Washington Post and the New York Times both pushed for the war, despite the fact that conservatives and Republicans will tell you that they are both liberal newspapers, their editorial pages pushed for war. And the Washington Post was particularly hawkish about it because I read all of those editorials. I thought they were wrong, but they're still pretty much skewed. I mean, their editorials are skewed in the direction of, yes, we did the right thing and we must confront Saddam, et cetera, et cetera, and now Iran, all of that. Well, Fred Hyatt writes this article in which he basically, he points out that in each section, whether it's nuclear, chemical, biological weapons, there's a clause in the report from the Senate that says that the president's statements were, quote, substantiated by intelligence information. And what they mean is it was generally substantiated by intelligence community estimates. In different places it says different things. But so Fred Hyatt's trying to make the case that Bush didn't really lie, that what happened was the intelligence was ambiguous, and he may have cherry-picked it a little, although he doesn't say that. He did it in good faith. No, he didn't do it in good faith. And when we come back, I'm going to explain to you the ways that he didn't do it in good faith.